Rainmaker.fm is brought to you by the Rainmaker Platform, a complete website solution for content marketers and online entrepreneurs. Find out more and take a free 14-day test drive at rainmakerplatform.com.
Seth Godin, we meet again. How are you, sir?
I'm fabulous. It's so great to talk to you.
Yes, it is great to have you back, and wonderful to see the work you're doing, which, of course, we're going to explore a little bit today. Now, Seth Godin probably doesn't need much of an introduction to most of you, just in case. He's the author of 17 best-selling books. One of those, Permission Marketing, was the first marketing book I ever read. Thank goodness I had nothing to unlearn. And that basically set me on the path I am today. He runs the most popular marketing blog in the world, I think by far. He's founded and sold several companies, but mainly I think he thinks of himself as a teacher, and he certainly has been one to me. As a reminder, I'm Brian Clark, founder and CEO of Copyblogger Media, and this is Rainmaker FM. Today, we're going to dig down a little bit with Seth. He's got a new book out. But I think we've got even a bigger scope of things to talk about, how it all ties together with the work that Seth is doing right now. So that's what I hope to accomplish today. Seth, let me start here. And I don't think this is something we've ever specifically discussed, but you spent 15 years as a book packager. And number one, I'm not sure everyone knows what that means, so let's start there. But talk a little bit about that period of your life.
Well, it's fair to say no one knows what it means. It's a little like being a movie producer, except for books. It turned out that until recently, there was a shortage of books. The world needed more books, particularly complicated books, than there were people to make them. So folks like me would come up with an idea, write down a proposal for the idea, and send it. And amazingly, all the publishers would let you send it to them at the same time. So I'd send it to the 30 publishers I worked with the most often. And if someone liked it, they would mail me money, and I would make the book. Some of the books had my name on it. Other books were bigger than that or had famous people's names on them. I did the Information Please Business Almanac, which was basically the internet in a hardcover book. I did books on gardening and investment and a whole range of stuff. I brought Stanley Kaplan into the book world. It took 3 years to get them to say I could make books with their name on it. Then I had to, you know, build the whole thing. So I loved that industry, and I learned a lot about work from that industry. There were two things particularly that resonated. One, almost everyone, with very few exceptions, was extraordinarily honest, kind, easy to work with, kept their word. That was really cool. And number two is, it's one of the only industries where you could get paid basically for ideas. You certainly had to implement them, but you would send an idea to somebody and they would send you back money. And once you get hooked on that cycle of creating for a marketplace and being able to do it professionally, it's pretty compelling.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's such an entrepreneurial activity. You're literally making something out of nothing other than an idea. You are taking disparate resources and putting them together, often without a net. And yet, when you talk about the post-industrial connection economy, was there a better training than this job?
Well, you see, I also learned a whole bunch of things that are dangerous and aren't true anymore. The first one was, the first year I was doing it, I was a complete failure. I sold nothing. And that's because I was trying to write for readers. I then learned that you have to write for editors, that the way you get a book published is making the intermediary happy, not by making the reader happy. That explains why you will see a lot of books in the bookstore that someone thought was a good idea, but the readers don't. And so in order to survive, that's what I did. But in a disintermediated connection economy, that doesn't work nearly as well. There isn't a middleman you have to please. There is an end user you have to delight. But the second thing that's really important that I learned and tried to teach the book industry, but they are resisting, is that in the book industry, the bookstore is their customer. That is who they focus all of their energy on. And my proof is that if you work in a bookstore, you have a phone number that you can call that will be instantly answered by someone at a publisher who will help you with your problem. But there is no phone number to call if you're a reader. They don't want to hear from readers. They want to hear from the middlemen. And once you can embrace the idea that your customer in the connection economy is the conversation, that you don't succeed unless person A tells person B, then you can start becoming focused on being in the connection business. And it's the connection business that we are all in now.
Excellent. So I wanted you to talk about that a little bit. Number one, because without what you did and what you learned in that role, I'm not sure the Seth Godin we have would be the same Seth Godin, which is true of anything, of course. But in this case, I think there's, you really see the evolution of that sort of role. And something we've been kicking around on this show in relation to a lot of things, but specifically to this broad concept of curation, everything from maybe putting together a newsletter that draws from different sources and becomes its own original commentary, to something like TED, which is a curated conference experience. The concept, the word, which I love, the impresario. And back in 2012, you wrote about the impresario and becoming that person. And you did a really interesting workshop, I believe, with some college students that was pretty amazing because you cranked out a book, I believe, with a group of kids. So the classical definition of impresario from the Italian, I guess, is, you know, it was a promoter of operas or concerts. And broadly, I guess the dictionary definition is someone who puts on an event, someone who puts it all together, much like a movie producer or a book packager. But you have a broader definition of impresario. And let me read that for people. One who gathers others together for creating art, the art of making a ruckus, the art of inventing the future, the art of important work. Now, I have not received my copies of your new book yet. They're en route. It's close. But from what I can tell, there's a direct line between this concept that you kicked around in 2012 and the new book. Talk about a little bit about what an impresario means to you.
Okay, so let me take it into two pieces. First, I think it is totally worthwhile for the Rainmaker audience to talk about what it is to be an impresario today, just from a technical business point of view. And if you go to your favorite search engine and type Skillshare Impresario Godin, those three words, you can get the course that I actually did, and it's free on Skillshare. You may have to sign up for Skillshare to see it, but it's a 3-hour lecture, and there's no upside for me other than sharing the insight, and I hope that people will try it. And what I argued there was there are really only two ways to go forward as a player in this economy. One is you can be a cog in the system hoping to get picked, a freelance writer that gets hired by Microsoft to write an article, or the person on the chocolate assembly line who puts the bonbons in the box, or the investor who waits for the stock to go up. These are players in a system bigger than any of us. The other thing that's new, relatively, is the ability to put on a show, to say, I'm going to assemble this information, these people, these resources, these assets, put this into the world and hope that people will embrace it. And impresarios range from, you know, the guy who started Comdex, which became the biggest trade show in the world, to somebody who is running a meetup in their little town, to somebody who, like a book packager, who puts together maybe brand names, maybe editors, maybe whatever, and makes a thing. And that spirit of being an impresario has to happen before you can do that work. You have to say, my role is to put on a show, and I have enough confidence in myself, and I care enough about the people who will interact with it that I'm willing to put myself on the line emotionally to do that. That leads to my second thing, which is, why is this hard? And it's hard not because we don't know how to do it, because we do. It's hard because we have been raised to need permission. And the impresario refuses to wait for permission. That's what makes them an impresario. So in fact, you are correct. It's a straight line from that to the new book, which is called What to Do When It's Your Turn. And again, trying not to be a hypocrite, I took my own advice. So I wrote it, I edited it, I laid it out myself, I published it myself. It's being printed in Vancouver and shipped from Seattle. Can't buy it on Amazon. It's at yourturn.link. And what I tried to do in the book is argue as cogently and passionately as I could that in this post-industrial world, there's a moment, I don't know how long it will last, when people can stand up, choose themselves, and say, here, I made this.
So dating back to the book packaging, to the fact that you just assembled, and I love the word assembled, this book from beginning to end, even in distribution, do you view yourself as an impresario? Is that who Seth is?
On a good day, there's no question about it. That is what I seek to do.
And on a bad day?
On a bad day, I have been known to answer 1,400 emails and do nothing of obvious productive value.
I think that's everyone, though. You can't really get too down on yourself for that, as long as you have more good days than bad, I would suspect.
I mean, it's very hard. You know, we have optimized our culture for the quick hit, the quick click, the burst of endorphin that one gets from seeing one mentioned by someone on Twitter or answering an email successfully or zinging someone like a troll. Those things, when we do them, feel pleasing. But if we do them long enough in a row, we create nothing. And so the hard work, at least for me, is to put all of those toys away and to sit with nothing until I am lonely enough, as Neil Gaiman has talked about, to actually do the hard work of starting something.
So I remember when you announced that you would no longer be working within the context of traditional publishing. Any regrets?
Well, the biggest regret is I said it in a broad way that made some people think that meant I wasn't going to be putting things on paper or sharing ideas, which wasn't what I was saying. I was talking to myself and basically saying, I worked super hard for a long time to earn the privilege of writing a book a year for trusted, esteemed colleagues in the book publishing industry, which is used to be so perfect because they would pay you a check, you would do the work, you would have a whole year to create this environment and then hand in this thing, and then they would do all the heavy lifting of spreading it. And so I did that many years in a row and loved every minute. But what became clear to me was that cycle had seduced me into insulating myself from certain parts of the market and working to please my editors, who were amazing but weren't necessarily my readers. That the books, making the bookstore happy is really different than making a reader happy. And so I wanted to put that stake in the ground so I wouldn't then, in the next lonely moment I had, turn around and go back to where I was, because I loved doing that, but this was scarier and I felt it was important to do it.
It's interesting that you say that, because it seems to me, relating back to what you learned from being a packager, that you knew not to focus on pleasing the intermediary, and yet it's so easy to do. These are your friends, these are your colleagues, these are people you respect, and yet you recognize the disparity between perhaps their sense of taste and what the audience really needs. Is that the right way to say that?
Well, I'm not even sure it's always taste. I think it's, every bestseller is a surprise bestseller. Every best-selling app is a surprise. Every best-selling book or movie is a surprise. And that's because the conventional wisdom wants to do what it did yesterday because it feels safer. And so there are endless rules of thumb about price points and formats and what a thing that is supposed to look like and what it's supposed to deliver. And if you want to change conversations, you have to break those expectations. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to have super brave publishers and editors who have encouraged me to do that sort of thing. But I end up feeling badly. So if I put a book in a cereal box and Barnes & Noble opens every cereal box and throws it out, I feel bad that I made my publisher waste all that money. So yes, you have to, at some level, take enough of a leap in who you choose to work with, that if you really want to do this work on the edge, you're going to make the very people you trust the most uncomfortable. And I saw you do this with your conference, your amazing conference, because it couldn't have been a unanimous vote of acclaim from your team when you said, let's go from this virtual electronic thing that involves serving no refreshments to strangers to building this thing that might not work. That's hard. And in order to do it, you need to look in the mirror and say, yeah, I want to do that because it's worth it.
Yeah, you pretty much nailed that one. Although they were very supportive, but my inner lizard brain was working overtime going, what if no one comes? What if no one buys anything? And I feel a little blessed in the sense that when I'm truly afraid of something, I have to do it. But I'm afraid that that's not everyone's reaction. The natural, as you know too well, response is to do nothing.
Right. Exactly.
Kind of along those lines. So this, now Icarus was a novel project, but it still was really kind of pre-funding, engaging interest. It was proving a case that you still took to a publisher. This time, it's just you. What's been the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge when I was working on the book was, is this enough? You know, I'm going way out on a limb, both financially and organizationally, to do this. Have I put enough tears into this book? Because I'm not going to get a chance to do it again. And I will confess that when I wrote the last essay in the book, I was in tears. And as I hold the book in my hand, I'm super pleased with it. There's very little other than the 7 typos that I want to fix. But once it was done, it's been extraordinary to see how a decade of permission marketing creates an asset of value. You know, if Walmart comes out with a new line of, I don't know, walkie-talkies and puts them at the cash register 2 weeks before Christmas, no one is surprised when they sell 1 million walkie-talkies, because Walmart's been spending 30 years building the value of the cash register before Christmas, so that of course they're going to sell 1 million walkie-talkies. And, you know, it's 30 years to be an overnight success. In this case, I said to my readers, I made this thing. Here's what it is. I'm not even going to tell you everything that's in it, which is the opposite of what Hollywood does and the opposite of what most things online are about. I hope you trust me enough to buy a few. And I sold 28,000 copies before we went to press. That's thrilling.
Wow.
Really thrilling, because to me, it was a validation of showing up every day for 10 years to say, here, what do you think of this? And so that raised the stakes for me, because I don't want to disappoint these people who get the 28,000 copies. So now the book is out and we're up to 40,000 copies after 10 days. And that's even more thrilling, because it means that the book is being spread and it's proving that maybe other people can do this too. And that's part of what I'm doing here. There are no secrets. There's no magic sauce. I sell no consulting. I'm basically saying to people, here's how I did this. You can do it too. Because if we can get more worthwhile ideas in the world, it will be a project I'm glad I did.
It's kind of amazing, considering that on a good day, depending on how the New York Times bestseller list works, you could get on that list with, what, 5,000 copies sold?
Yep.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, as you know, but 40,000 copies, that's amazing. So I purchased 3 copies, one for myself and one for each of my 2 children, who are 9 and 12.
Yay!
And I can't think of a better way than to hand my daughter a book about it being her turn. And, you know, because I found this, and your kid just went to college, so you've been through this, but they don't listen to their parents necessarily. But if they see something, maybe it's a beautiful book such as this, or it's their basketball coach who tells them the exact same thing their dad just told them, but all of a sudden it makes sense to them when he tells them. It's just very refreshing to have this resource. So I know you've purposefully not said on page 32, you'll find this nugget of wisdom, you know, the typical book marketing type thing. But if I want to pre-sell this book to my children, it should arrive any day. What would I tell them? What from the mouth of Seth, should I say, here's what this is. I want you to look forward to it and take a look when it gets here.
On page 32, there's a story about the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, made famous by Ghostbusters.
That's right.
But no, in fact, there is that story, but you don't have to pre-sell the book because the book is pretty enough that it better sell itself. The real challenge, and I wrote it for your kids without even knowing you were going to get it for them, but that's who it's really for, is for the parents who have been seduced and brainwashed by the industrial economy to have the guts to consistently honor the kind of stuff that you and I are talking about. That when you raise free-range kids and you talk to them about being the best in the world at something, you talk to them about being an impresario and failing and making a connection, when they come home with a C in biology, you're not allowed to say, you need to get an A, even if it means doing less of that thing that you are great at.
Right.
And so I worked so hard when I was raising my two sons with my wife to create that environment where we meant it, right? That it was more important to us that you successfully edit a Wikipedia article than it was that you do well in algebra in eighth grade. Because one is about compliance and the other one is about generously contributing. And what we need to figure out how to do during this interregnum period is how to raise kids who don't measure their worth in the famousness of the college they get into or the number of digits in their SAT score, but in fact can point to a trail they leave behind, a trail of projects, a trail of connections, a trail of overwhelming expectations with the big promises that they make and deliver on. That cycle can't start when they're 24. It has to start when they're 9.
Yes. I love the term free-range kids, and it's more of an intellectual thing than necessarily roaming the way kids don't seem to get to do anymore, but I did as a kid. The interesting thing to me is with the rate of change, and we hear a lot about this, you've just sent your children off to college. And I even wonder in 5 or 8 years with my two, does college serve the purpose we think it does anymore? Do you think about that?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, different colleges are approaching this problem in different ways. There is no doubt that there is a higher education bubble going on. There is no doubt that we have confused certification with accreditation, with competence, with desire. And there's also no doubt that the combination of sort of tribal behavior, binge drinking, organized sports in certain institutions is really belying the whole reason that we invented higher education in the first place. So with all of that wrapped up together, the question is, you know, what are we hoping these kids will be doing in 20 years? And the chances that they will be a middle manager moving paper around in a skyscraper in Midtown Manhattan for $200,000 a year are very, very, very low. And I get that that was the ticket out for our grandparents and that that was the home run for our parents. But if that's what we're training kids to do now, to have no real obvious best in the world, scary skills, that they're not trained in, you know, I can take an idea and make it real, but they are trained in, I can go to a meeting, tell me where the meeting is being held, and I will take good notes and say back to you what you just told me. I think we have wasted years of their lives and $250,000 of tuition.
Yeah, from my perspective, of course, I just like to teach them to be entrepreneurs so they never have to rely on anyone else. They never have to be picked by anyone else. On the other hand, I'd like them to get a good liberal arts education like I had. I have a law degree that I no longer use technically, but I'll tell you what, the way I was trained to think in law school has served me every day since. So I really struggle with, you know, 4 to 7 years of binge drinking, which, let's face it, that is a big part of the college experience, unfortunately. And then not only that, but taking them out effectively of what's happening in the world.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, we need liberal artists, but famous colleges are not training liberal artists. Famous colleges are training pre-law students.
Yeah.
And there's something different that if I walked into a second year philosophy course at almost any famous college and said to any individual in the room, what would you do about Terry Schiavo, right? Would they be capable of having a cogent conversation with me? Or would they say, well, that wasn't on the last test?
Yes.
And that's the problem. You know, I've been in the last couple of days confronted with not one, but two examples of marketing courses that are being run at institutions you would have heard of. And I have to tell you, I am stunned at, and then marketing is obviously not liberal arts, but it's being taught like a liberal arts class in these two cases, being stunned at A, the age of the textbook that's being used, B, the things that they're being asked to memorize, C, the vocabulary that the teacher is saying is important, but most of all, the way the interactions go. So in one class, each student is expected to give a PowerPoint presentation. They are marked off if there aren't four bullet points on each one of the slides describing in detail something that came from the notes. And it's an industrialized, memorized process in which no one is being taught to think about anything. And this is an area I have some expertise in. And I'm just looking at this mouth agog saying, these people are going to be leaving the institution thinking they learned something when in fact they learned nothing.
Yeah, that really worries me. And I like to almost brag about how abjectively clueless I was when I came to the internet about marketing and how permission marketing was, you know, oh, this is how you do it. Okay, great. But that's not entirely intellectually honest because I majored in psychology with minors in sociology and philosophy. I got the groundwork, like you wouldn't believe, of what marketing, certainly modern marketing, really is. And yet my mother, of course, thought I was wasting my time. Turned out fine, though. Is it too soon to ask what's next for Seth Godin?
You should ask all you want. I have made it my full-time job to figure out the answer. I'm sitting here with Winnie Kao, who's working with me full-time on that very process. I have made it into a process. There's a wall covered with cards and notes and plans, and we're having a sprint for a few invited guests next week where we're going to talk about one of them in detail. And I'm not going to rush it. I got to figure out how to use this platform in a way that matters. And if I don't do it the first time, I'll do it the second time or the third time. But it's tempting to hide, and I'm trying very hard to not do so.
It's a lesson right there, though, about how the next thing evolves. Process, not necessarily concrete plans. So, Seth, thank you so much for your time. Please tell everyone where they can find out more about the book and, more importantly, get their own copies.
If it's interesting to you, I hope you'll go to yourturn.link, yourturn.link. You cannot buy one copy, but you can buy more than one because the whole point is to share it. And I will finish by saying, you, sir, are the poster child for that. You have been sharing from the first day I met you, and I hope your listeners and readers understand just how extraordinary the consistent generosity is. It's not easy to do, and you keep pulling it off.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you again for your time, and happy holidays, Seth.
All right. We'll see you soon.